Good morning. So good to be with you this morning. Love the weather. Reminds me of where I live. The Texas Panhandle stays nice and cool in the morning all year round, just about. You know, I have a hard time believing that, living in this part of Texas, don't you? But I live in Texas where it's nice and cold, high altitude, right at the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. We actually have that part of Texas that we get to live in every day, and we like it this cold. And so, good to be here with you. Thank you for the weather. I know it's not your doing, but it's God's. But it's good to be here with you and to be able to talk about these important subjects. Today we're going to be talking about, in our very first lesson, about evidence for a young earth. Science and the Bible versus evolution's dating of the earth. You know, the evolution's date this earth is very old. And we are going to look at two specific questions. Number one, does it really matter? A lot of people who are members of the church say, well, it really doesn't matter. That's their idea. That's their opinion. It doesn't matter. And so they just don't take this very seriously. And then we're also going to answer this question, what about radiometric dating? Because we can spend our weekend talking about these things. And you bring this up, and then there's somebody who says, well, you know, radiometric dating answers all that. Well, no, it doesn't. And we're going to show you why it doesn't. It's really important to address that specifically. When you look at Exodus chapter 20, when God's given the Ten Commandments, He reminds the people of Israel what He did in the beginning. In Exodus 20, verse 8, He says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. You see, they're in the wilderness. They know what a day is. They know what a week is. And so He says, 6 days you here in the wilderness, are going to labor and do all thy work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath unto Jehovah thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou nor thy son nor thy daughter, thy manservant nor thy maidservant, nor the cattle, nor thy strangers within thy gates. Now, in the same thought, the same sentence, where he's saying, you know, you have these days that you experience in the wilderness. He said, just like that, in 6 days, Jehovah made heaven and earth and seeing all that in them is and rested the seventh day. Wherefore, Jehovah blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. You see, the meaning of this is pretty straightforward. The days you have in the wilderness, it's like the days that I use to make the world, God says. Very straightforward. 6 days of creation. However, a more modern reading would be those who believe in evolution to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days thou shalt labor. And you skip down to verse 11. For in 6 billion years, Jehovah made heaven and earth to see it all that in them is and rested the 7 billion years. Wherefore, Jehovah blessed the Sabbath 1 billion years and hallowed them. Isn't that pretty much what people are saying today? When they believe in theistic evolution and they try to make the days not 24-hour days, they try to make them billions of years. It's kind of like advertising your business, open 6 billion years a week. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense, does it? So don't care what language you're reading, we're reading English today. It just is pretty straightforward and simple to understand. If you go to science books, all the way back into elementary school, and they talk about 30 million years ago, depending on what they're talking about. You see this illustration, and I want to blow up what it said. And about 30 million years ago, larger primates such as monkeys and apes evolved. And the earliest fossil apes, it may be ancestral to both humans and modern apes, and he goes on. Talking about ancient ages for the earth, going way back millions of years. So I want to just tell you right now, when you see a story that starts out with long ago and far away, you're getting to see a fairy tale. And this is a fairy tale, people, that we came here as a product of evolution, that the world made itself without any intelligent design, seriously. That's what you want us to believe, and that's what's taught in school. And here's the fairy tale, that's Grandpa. No, that's not Grandpa, but that is the fairy tale we're being told. Now, I used to be extremely careful, and you noticed last night that I used this word, ape-like ancestors, that the evolutionists teach us that we evolved from ape-like ancestors, and they get upset sometimes if you say, Well, we evolved from monkeys. That's what they tell us. You know, we evolved from monkeys. Oh, no, no. They say it's not monkeys. It's ape-like ancestors. And I used to be pretty sensitive to that. I still don't try to violate that. But when you look at quotes like this, taken out of science books that say you're an animal and share a common heritage with earthworms, I'm like, wait a second. When you tell us we evolved from earthworms, why are you getting upset if someone says monkey instead of ape-like ancestor? I don't quite understand that logic. But that's what takes place so many times. So in this evolutionary worldview, they believe that the Big Bang happened. And people say, you don't believe in the Big Bang? I said, no, I don't. I believe in the big word. You read about that in Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2. You read about it in John chapter 1, the first three verses. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And you see that this world was spoken into existence. But the evolutionists tell us that it all took place about 10, and I think the more popular number now is about 14 billion years ago. Somewhere between 10 and 20 billion years, and our solar system evolved in the last 5 billion, with Earth evolving in the last 4.6 billion years. And the evolutionists really like that number, 4.6. And the single-cell organisms began to evolve about 3 to 4 billion years ago, multiple cell organisms about a billion years ago, with humankind having gotten here the last 1 to 3, or maybe some even stretch it out to 8 million years. Modern civilization being here in the last 5 to 10,000 years, I think that's a unique number. When they say modern civilization has been here 5 to 10,000 years, and you look at the Bible and it seems to indicate that we've been here about 6,000 years. And then they show the geologic time scale with the index fossils that are supposed to index these ages. Going back millions of years, it's just kind of like if you take a drill, you know, East Texas is oil country, just kind of like West Texas. And if you take a drilling rig and go down through the sediment, you can go see these different layers of sediment. And what they're telling us is when you do that, what you're looking at is a history about how this world evolved. Boy, I tell you what, they leave a lot of things out on that story. We're going to look at some of those here this morning. Now, this was referred to in the short review that our brother gave, where evolutionists actually believe in miracles. Professor George Wald, a PhD in biochemistry, who taught biology at Harvard, Nobel Prize winner, said, "Time is, in fact, the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible." He's referring to evolution as impossible, and it is. But he says, given time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible probable, the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs miracles. What does he say? Time performs miracles. Here's the deal. They really do believe that time performs miracles. You see, everything in science works against evolution. And there's really no scientific evidence for the general theory of organic evolution. But it's kind of like they believe that time is the rug you can sweep all of these problems under. One of the problems we referenced last night is there are no transitional forms in the fossil record. Darwin said, "I don't see them, but you'll find them sooner or later." Well, they hadn't found them yet. And you look through this fossil record, if evolution is true, there should be transitional forms where you see one kind becoming another kind, but there are none. But don't worry about that. We'll just, with enough time, sweep that under the rug. There's no mechanism in biology to explain the general theory of organic evolution. But give us time, we'll sweep that under the rug. The design of living things is contrary to evolution. But give us time, we'll sweep that problem under the rug. And as we talked about last night, the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, one of the two laws that scientists have the most confidence in. In other words, you take all the other laws of science, you get rid of them and just leave the two that they believe in the most. It's the first and second law of thermodynamics. And the second law, the law of entropy, just goes directly opposite of the general theory of evolution. But that doesn't matter. Give them time. Are you starting to get the idea why time's so important to the evolutionists? It's all important. But time does not minimize the problems of evolution. Even if there's been 15 to 20 billion years, there's not been enough time for evolution to have occurred. Not at all. And I want you to also note, if the universe is not billions and billions of years old, there's just not been enough time in the evolutionist point of view. You see, we think of millions as a big number. No, the evolutionists is kind of like the federal, people up in D.C. that set the federal budget. They spend billions like you and I spend a $20 bill. And they just throw around billions of dollars, and the evolutionist throws around billions of years. Let me just tell you this right now. If we could show in their mind that this universe is only several million years old, we will have defeated from their point of view the whole idea of evolution. Because from their point of view, millions is way too young. You got to give them billions of years. Now I want to familiarize you with these false theories that a lot of members of churches and all different religions, including churches of Christ, have used to try to reinterpret the Bible. They want to believe in the old earth. In fact, there was a guy, someone brought it up last night. There was a guy, an elder in a church down in Huntsville, who had this Lord I Believe series. He was going around, and he had a whole team that would come in. And they would sit up, and in some churches they would put their posters up on the walls, and they had special classes for the kids. And they were passing out, especially in the class for the kids, the geologic column, and teaching them that the universe is just as old as any evolutionist would teach. And that was really prominent. Now, about 20-something years ago, I was invited to go to Fort Worth, Texas. And they said, when you come, and it was because of this controversy on the age of the earth, they said, we want you to speak on the age of the earth. I said, well, you know, my series, I don't have a lesson I really like on that subject. And the preacher said, you don't get it. You don't teach on the age of the earth. You're not coming. The invitation's over. I said, okay. And I threw out the old lesson, and I totally reworked it. And I continue to rework things because if you know me very well, I'm never satisfied. I'm not satisfied with myself at all. I'm always trying to improve my work. And so this lesson's continued to evolve. It's a very important lesson. And I'm not taking the credit for it, but I think brethren finally had enough of this Lord I Believe series, and I have not seen that go around for quite a long time. And I've had elders in churches when I go and speak different areas where they say, I want to talk to you a little bit. We had these people come in. We didn't know that's what they were going to do. And we didn't know how to handle that. And I said, you handle it like any other false teachers up there preaching false doctrine. What do? Just go ahead and have a full weekend of it? Is that what you do? You know, I think y'all have leadership that's a lot further beyond that. And that's good for y'all. And it's important to have leaders that don't allow false teachings to continue to be taught. But I want to show you what a lot of these people will do. First of all, they present the gap theory. It's the idea that there's been vast geologic ages, that this world was here for millions upon millions, maybe billions of years, and that's where we get all this sediment, you know. And then what happened? Well, Satan, you know, he was a bad guy, and God took him by the nape of the neck, so to speak, and threw him down to the earth. And when he hit the earth, it just destroyed everything. And what you read about in Genesis 1 is not the original creation. You read about the second creation, how God created the world on top of all those geologic sedimentary ages, so to speak. And so what they do is they take all this history that the geologic column supposedly represents, and they just squeeze it in somewhere in there between Genesis chapter 1:1 and 1:2. You can't read the Bible and get that idea. It's not what the Bible's talking about. And then there's the progressive creation theory. And that's what the Lord I Believe people, I believe, were teaching. It's the idea that originally God allowed this stellar evolution to take place. We kind of referred to that last night. But then when it came to the point in time for life, then God progressively created. What he would do is he would create as if it evolved. So here would be, you know, here we're going to have fish, and then we're going to have amphibians. And they were going to have land animals, and God would create it, but it would take long periods of time. And I approached the guy that was hitting up this Lord I Believe series, and I said, now, I've been told that you teach that when you read Genesis 1, those are literal 24-hour days. He said, oh, yeah, that's what I teach. I said, can you explain that to me? How can you teach all these thousands upon thousands and millions of years and teach those are 24-hour days? He said, oh, well, what you need to do is you need to understand this. Those days you read in Genesis chapter 1 are announcement days. So a literal 24-hour day, God used that to announce what he was getting ready to do. I said, well, that's pretty interesting. You see, a lot of brethren are pretty naive. I hate to tell you that, but it's just the truth. Too many of us are naive. Someone says something and we're through asking questions. You know why? Because if you ask enough questions, well, what is it like in school? You raise your hand up, hey, I got a question. And so the teacher calls on you, you ask the question. And then you got your hands up again, I got another question. Now you kids know as well as I do that what happens if you just keep asking questions all the time? Well, you get labeled as a troublemaker. Not with me. I've been a professor in three different institutions of higher learning. University of Texas is one of them. And I will just tell you that I look at people that ask questions not as troublemakers, but as budding scientists. People that want to know, how do you know that to be true? Well, but here's the deal. And I'm just going to spill beans here, Brother Steve. Because sometimes in churches, we ask questions. Now, I know it's not here, your leadership, you're not intimidated. But someone says, well, yeah, I believe in 24-hour days. Oh, okay. You go on down the road. No, I got a question. My question is, how can you say that those days are 24-hour days and teach this universe being billions of years old and pass out the geologic column in your meetings? How does that go together? And then you get labeled as a troublemaker. Well, I think you get labeled as someone who knows how to think. And I told you one of my goals here with you all this weekend, if you're not already a thinker, is to help stimulate your thinking, get you to be a better thinker. And so what they do is they take all these levels of the old ancient earth that people believe, if they believe in evolution, and they just kind of squeeze it into Genesis chapter 1. The day-age theories, the idea that these days you read about in Genesis 1 are vast geologic ages. And so you're not reading days. When it says the word day, God didn't mean it. He didn't mean a day. No, he meant a long period of time, like millions or billions. Depends on where you are. You know, if we're starting out with the beginning of the universe, that would be billions. And if we're talking about life itself, that would be millions. And so then there's a framework hypothesis. And I remember the first time I heard of this, I said, no, explain that to me again. Well, the idea of the framework hypothesis is not that Genesis 1 and 2 tell us how God made all of this. What the idea is, that you just need to know God was involved. Really? That God was just involved. But it has nothing to do with what really happened. Well, there's those people that say, what difference does it make? And I said, well, that's a good question. And I'm glad to answer that question. You see, the first problem these old earth theories have in common is they make the days of Genesis 1 and 2 figurative. Well, they're written literal. And let me tell you, if you can start making just anything you want to in the Bible figurative, whoa, where's the stopping place? I can just teach you pretty much anything I want to if I get to choose what's figurative. You see? That's a problem. Some say, well, isn't it true that God doesn't really look at time as meaning much at all? Time doesn't mean anything to God. And I go, really? Where does the Bible say that? And then someone says, well, doesn't the Bible say somewhere that in Bible time, a day is 1,000 years? And I go, no. It doesn't. You show me where it is. No, what they do is they'll go, no. I want you, Bonner. You show me the verse that I'm thinking of. And I go, well, the Bible doesn't say that. But I will show you the verse that you're misconstruing to say that just because I'm teaching. But if I'm in a Bible study with somebody, I may not necessarily say, yeah, it says that, or here's what you're thinking about, and give it to them. Isn't that kind of funny how people misquote the Bible and they want you to give them the verse? Well, what they're thinking about is 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 through 11, where he says, forget not this one thing, beloved, that one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. Did he say, in Bible time, a day is 1,000 years? No, he says as. And what he's talking about is the memory of God. But let me just tell you this. If he's saying a day is 1,000 years, then he's saying that, you know what? I don't care if Adam lived 936 years. That wasn't even a day. Because in Bible time, a day is 1,000 years? But wait a second. Which way do you want it? Because he says it both ways. What he's doing is, when you look at the text, he's talking about the mind of God. You know, I forget things, and I know maybe most of y'all have a photographic memory. My dad did. But I tend to forget a few things. But I'll tell you what, I usually have a pretty good handle on what happened last week. And so what he's telling us in this text is, if you understand that in the mind of God, 1,000 years takes place, it's about like a day. How do you think you ought to be behaving yourself? If this world's been here 6,000 years, it's kind of like it's been here a week. God has a pretty good memory on what all of us have been up to. So how do you think you ought to be acting? That's really what the context is talking about. Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, we see that God defines the day. Verse 5, he says, there was an evening and morning one day. So you got a rotation of the earth. On the first day, God made heaven, earth, seas, light, day, and night. You got a rotation of the earth, evening and morning. That's a day. He defines that. Exodus chapter 20, verse 11, for in 6 days Jehovah made heaven and earth. He uses the word days. He shows the days of creation were the same days the Israelites had in the wilderness. He uses the word yom for day, the Hebrew word yom, found 2,291 times. Almost always literal, but here's the deal. When it's used with an ordinal number, and an ordinal number is like first, second, third, fourth, that's an ordinal number. Cardinal numbers like 1, 2, 3, 4. When he uses the ordinal number, without exception, it's always literal. But here's the deal. When you're looking at Exodus chapter 20, he's using the plural word days, and that's the Hebrew word yamin. And without exception, all 845 times it's used, always literal. Always. No exception. Don't try to tell me this is just figurative. The second problem the old earth theories have in common is they redefine God. You see, throughout the Bible, the Old and the New Testament, God is defined as our creator. You look at Acts chapter 4, verse 24, when Peter and John were released from prison, they go to the brethren, they pray prayers of thanksgiving, and when they heard that, they lifted up their voice to God with one accord and said, Lord, thou art God who hast made the heaven and the earth, the sea, and all that in them is. We address God as our creator. Acts 14 and verse 15. And saying, sirs, why do you do these things? And they were trying to worship Paul and Barnabas. Paul and Barnabas said, no, stop right there. We also are men of passions with you and preach unto you that ye should turn away from vanities unto the living God who made the heaven and the earth and sea and all things therein. For these pagan people, Paul is explaining who God is. He's the God of creation. In Acts 17, when he's on the Areopagus at Mars Hill, he's telling them the God he worships. He'd been looking through all these idols that they had there in Athens, and he saw one that was given to the unknown God. He says, what you worship in ignorance is the God that I actually worship. Verse 24 of Acts 17, and God that made the world and all things therein, seeing he is the Lord of heavens and earth, dwelled not in temples made with hands. You see, we define God in the Bible, God does, as the God of creation. The God that says he made it in 6 days. The God explained how he made it in Genesis 1. In Revelation 14, 6 through 7, we have an answer to this question. The question is this. A lot of people say, well, can't you just preach the gospel? Kind of leave this stuff about evolution alone. You know, and I go, what do you mean by the gospel? Well, you know, to be baptized for remission of sins. Let's just agree on that. We can disagree on this other stuff. It doesn't really matter. And I'm going, is that what the gospel is only? Look at the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 14, 6 through 7 talks about this angel having the everlasting gospel. Fear God and give glory to him and worship him that made heaven, the earth, the sea, and the fountains of waters. The gospel is we got to believe in God, and the God we believe in is the God of creation. That is part of the gospel. And if you don't believe in the God of creation, you're not even gotten to first base when it comes to obeying the plan of salvation. Because the first step is once you've heard the word, we've got to believe. And don't tell me that someone who doesn't believe in God, don't tell me that you can believe in God without believing he's the God of creation. And that's okay. Maybe you start off that way. Maybe you start off uninformed about what the Bible fully teaches, but you just can't stay there. Here's the third problem these old earth theories have in common. They contradict Jesus. Mark chapter 10 and verse 6. Jesus said, "But from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female." From the beginning of the creation. We're in the creation now. But from the beginning of the creation that we're in, on the sixth day, God made Adam. And He made Eve. And that's from the beginning. But no, the evolutionists say, hey, if this world is 20 billion years old and man has only been here for the last 1 to 3 billion years, you know what they're saying? They're saying Jesus lied. Because man hadn't been here from the beginning of this creation that we're in. No, He's only been here in the last 0.005% of time. That pretty well makes Jesus a liar, doesn't it? Fourth problem. These old earth theories have in common to make Jesus Christ, the Apostle Paul, to be liars. Since Jesus and Paul both refer to creation as a literal event. Mark 13:19. "For in those days shall be affliction, such as was not from the beginning of the creation which God created unto this time." Jesus is talking about this affliction that's going to happen. And He says it hadn't been anything like this unless you go all the way back to creation that He's referring to as a literal event. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, 13 through 14, Paul says, "For Adam was first formed, then Eve." That's Genesis 2. You're telling me that really didn't happen, that man evolved? Then you're saying the Apostle Paul is a liar. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 8 and 9, he says, "For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man." That's Genesis chapter 2. You start preaching evolution, theistic evolution, if you will. You're making the Apostle Paul and Jesus Christ Himself out to be liars. So someone says, "Well, what difference does it make?" Well, Jesus answers that question in John 3 and verse 12. "If I told you earthly things and you believe not, how shall you believe if I tell you heavenly things?" Why in the world would you believe Jesus on the plan of salvation? Why would you believe Jesus on heaven and hell if Jesus lied about the creation of the world? And you want me to believe it doesn't make a difference? It just flies all over me when Christians talk like that. I don't get it. It makes a difference. I hope you can see why. Well, here's the deal. I, along with a number of other scientists, believe the world's probably only about 6,000 to 10,000 years old for two reasons. Number one, the Bible seems to indicate that when you read Genesis chapter 1 through 11. But in addition to that, the scientific evidence seems to indicate and be more consistent with a young earth that had a worldwide flood than it is with a very old ancient earth that's billions of years old. I have said this, and I still hold this 100%. If I lost my faith in God, and I didn't believe in God anymore, I would have a real dilemma. Because once you look at the scientific evidence for a young earth, I would go, "Well, I may not believe in God, but I have to believe in the young earth because science just says it's that way." You see? That's a problem. And I want you to see some of the science. Evolutionists try to date the earth primarily by two methods. One is referred to as a relative dating method. In other words, when an evolutionist who is a geologist looks at a rock and he says, "Well, how old is this rock?" Or a paleontologist looks at the fossil and says, "How old is the fossil?" Then what they do is they refer to what's called relative dating. It's actually circular reasoning. So what you do is the geologist, if y'all ask him, "How do you know the rock is this old?" He says, "Well, go ask the paleontologist. He'll tell you the fossils that are in that rock layer are, say, 400 million years old." So you go down the hall in the science building and you ask the paleontologist, you say, "Hey, how do you know that fossil's 400 million years old?" He says, "Well, that's simple. The rock layer it's in is 400 million years old." You see what just happened? The paleontologist who's the geologist's source of authority says, well, the rock is that old, therefore the fossil has to be. And the geologist says, well, the rock has to be this old because the paleontologist tells me the fossil's that old. That's why it's called relative, because it's very subjective and it's a matter of opinion, and that's how they do it. And those who are evolutionists will admit this is circular reasoning. For example, Tom Kemp, a noted evolutionist, said a circular argument arises. Interpret the fossil record in terms of a particular theory of evolution. Inspect the interpretation. Notice that it confirms the theory. Well, it would, wouldn't it? David Kitts, another notable evolutionist, said the record of evolution, like any other historical record, must be construed within a complex of particular and general preconceptions, not the least of which is the hypothesis that evolution has occurred. So this relative dating method that we just use each other, the circular reasoning is our source of authority. You have to, first of all, just presume and assume that evolution took place. You've got to make some assumptions about these dates. And then Niles Eldridge, you can go down to Barnes & Noble and pick up books that he's written. Such a famous evolutionist says, and this poses something of a problem. If we date the rocks by the fossils, how can we then turn around and talk about patterns of evolutionary change through time in the fossil record? You see, they understand this is a problem. It's circular reasoning. Well, that's the relative dating method, and then there is what's called the absolute method. Now, absolute's their terminology. I didn't use this. It's their terminology. And the idea is not that you can say, well, you know, on April the 26th, back in and quote a certain date that this happened. That's not the idea. When they say absolute method, what they're saying is it's less subjective, it's more objective, and it's based on radioactive decay. So you take uranium-238, and it's not stable. It gives off an alpha particle. Now, what an alpha particle is basically a helium. So it gives off helium, atomic weight 4, and you get thorium-234, which becomes protactinium-234, which becomes uranium-234, which gives off an alpha particle, and it becomes thorium-230, and you see the deal. They just keep giving off these radioactive particles. That's why the element is radioactive. It gives off particles, and it becomes something else. So I want to teach you a little bit of terminology. The uranium-238 or anything else that's in a radioactive series like this, it starts out what you call a parent element. And it produces daughter elements. Yeah, just kind of like with people or animals, where you've got a parent and you've got a daughter or a child. And so that's what they're saying. And what they're talking about is you can measure this, and this helps you know how old the Earth is. But you need to know a few things. Number one, radiometric dating is not used on sedimentary rocks like limestone, sandstone. It's used for igneous rocks that were once molten. You know, we're talking like lava. And so, if you're in school and they're showing the geologic column, what should you do? How do you know it's that old? And if the answer is, well, radiometric dating tells us that, please don't be a smart aleck and get yourself in trouble with the teacher. But think to yourself, bless their heart. They don't even know what they're talking about. I was given this series a number of years ago in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Preacher, so we don't have anything to do during the day. You're not speaking until tonight. Have you ever been to Mammoth Caves? And I said, no, I'd love to go. So he takes me out to Mammoth Caves. We're down under this rock layer, and he says, you know, what's right above us here? About 400 million years old. And the preacher, he kind of nudges me a little bit. He goes, you got a question? I said, yeah, I'm just kind of curious. How do you know that? He said, well, we use radiometric dating to know that. I said, isn't that limestone above us? He goes, yeah. I said, well, isn't limestone a sediment? Oh, yeah. I said, do you happen to know that You don't use radiometric dating to date sediment? And the guy went ballistic on me. And I'm not going to get there in an argument. I just looked at him, you know, give him the look like you're not impressed. And we went on and finished the tour, and we're going out the parking lot. This guy, he chases me down. And I'm like, oh, no. You know, what's going to happen here? And but no, he comes up to me and he says, evidently you know more about this than I do. And he says, you know, I only have a master's degree in geology. And I said, well, here's the deal. Go back if you still have your library books and get your freshman geology book. You know, Geology 101. And look it up. And it's going to tell you in that freshman geology book that radiometric dating is not used to date sediment. It's just anybody who knows anything about radiometric dating knows this. But yet, people quote this all the time to say, like, well, we know how old it is because radiometric dating. I got to tell you, we went back years later for a debate, and I've got my son Reagan with me, and we're in this bus because, man, the caves, they bus you out to the opening of the cave. And I'm looking up there at the front of the bus. We're sitting in the back, and I said, nudge Reagan. I said, you see that park ranger up there? He's looking at me. I think he remembers me. Here's another thing you need to know, is the issue of radiometric dating is not about our ability to measure the rate of decay. We can do that. Engineers, scientists, we can measure that rate of decay. That's not the issue. The issue is all about the assumptions. So how do you date an object? First of all, you observe it. You observe the present state of a system that you're wanting to date. You measure the process rate within the system. How fast is this happening? How fast is uranium becoming thorium or one of the other daughter elements? And then you make assumptions about the past. And then you calculate the time necessary for that process to produce the present state. Now, what are the assumptions of radiometric dating? Assumption number one is that decay rate has always been constant. You see, we're not old enough to know that it's always been constant. And I'm not even making an argument based on that. I just want to point out we don't know. It's always been constant. And I'll even tell you this. I was telling this last night to somebody. I studied astronomy when I was in college, and I continue to periodically read astronomy magazines. And here's what's interesting. There's some evolutionary astronomers that are now questioning the speed of light. That's interesting. Because in physics, we've used this letter K as a constant, and many times K is the speed of light, you know, 186,000 miles per second. And now evolutionary scientists are saying, well, we're not for sure. It's always been that. It may have used to have been incredibly faster. And they're saying we may have evidence of that. Well, we don't know that. I'm not questioning it. Don't go misquote me saying I question it. I'm just saying there's some scientists that are now questioning some of these things as whether they've always been that constant rate. Here's another assumption, that it's a closed system. There's been no gain or loss of parent or daughter elements, and that we have knowledge of the starting conditions, that we know absolutely how much daughter was there at the start. You see, if there's a lot of daughter elements now, it looks pretty old according to this assumption method. Let's make this easy. You come home from a trip. You go up to the rain gauge. It's raining outside. You go, I wonder how long it's been raining. That's the same question that scientists ask when they're looking at a particular rock that you can use radiometric dating on. So they say, well, how long has it been raining? Well, that's the question. And you observe the present state of the system, and you realize the rain gauge has 2 inches of rain. 2 inches. Then you measure the process rate. Well, you weren't there for the first 2 inches, and that's the question, how long has it been raining? So you sit back and you watch it for an hour, and you realize that it takes an hour for it to rain an inch. And then you go to step four. You calculate the time necessary for that process to produce the observed condition. So you had 2 inches. The process rate is 1 hour per inch. And you go, well, it must have been raining for 2 hours. Is that the correct age of the system? Or do you have any questions? You'll notice I bypassed step number 3, making the assumptions. And I see a lot of scientists observing what I call the Passover by not explaining all the assumptions. See, assumption number 1 is there's been a constant decay rate, that you measured the process after those 2 inches. So you don't know for sure. I saw some people actually teaching theistic evolutionists and not doing the assumptions and doing exactly what the evolutionists have done, and they use the rain illustration. I read things like that, and I go between wanting to laugh and wanting to cry. Now, when I lecture in Oregon, I lived in Oregon for 4 years, and I realized there in Portland area, it takes 9 months to give you 40 inches of rain, so it's just a mist, constant all the time. So there are some places in the country it's kind of like that with a few exceptions. However, what about down here? Always rain at the same level? I was telling Gail when we were driving down here, so it kind of reminds me of the first time I drove to Houston. This huge rainstorm came up. The speed limit was still 70, and I could just feel my Ford LTD just lift up off the ground. I had never driven in rain like that before, and I quickly started shutting the speed down so I get the wheels back on the concrete. You see, you know as well as I do, sometimes it rains slowly, sometimes more moderately, and sometimes what do you get down here and you end up with a flood? Just massive amounts of raining, what we call cats and dogs, for a couple of days, and now you got a flood. And so you're making some assumptions. Because it may have been raining more slowly, more quickly, or maybe the same rate. But we just really don't know. And the second assumption is that there's been no gain. You see, there could have been other sources of water going into that rain gauge. Maybe somebody turned on the sprinkler system. And then there might have been some kid that goes over and empties out the rain gauge, or maybe partially does it, turns on the spigot. And that would mess with your assumptions, wouldn't it? And then you have to assume maybe you're gone for 2 weeks, that it never rained in between, and you know the starting level. Now, it's one thing to go out here and be home all the time, empty out your rain gauge, know the starting level, sit it there, and then see how much rain we got in the last few hours. But our problem is you don't know that. So these are assumptions that are all being made about radiometric dating, a constant rate, that you got a closed system, and the initial conditions are known at the start. Now, it's not necessarily wrong for scientists to speculate about these things, but I would think they need to do it with a little bit more humility. However, in textbooks and at the National State Parks, on the Discovery Channel, National Geographic Channel, they're always telling this as if we know how old all of this stuff is. And the fourth assumption is a real Achilles heel of radiometric dating, because if you have daughter elements present at the start, it makes the system look pretty old from their point of view. In practice, how does it work? Well, how would you figure it out? It's kind of like this. I used to be a weighmaster for a wrestling club. And we would have these scales, and we'd get them calibrated. So you get a guy that's paid to calibrate, and he'd bring in a weight. Maybe it's 10 pounds. He knows exactly it's 10 pounds. He puts it on your scale and sees, does it read 10? And if it doesn't, he's got to recalibrate the scale. So how would you calibrate these scales? Here's what you do. You take rocks where you know how old they are, and you use radiometric dating on them and see, well, does it work? So you go down to Sunset Crater in Arizona, and we ask, well, how old is this lava? Well, there's Indian artifacts in the lava flows. And the Indians tell the story this activity was about 900 years ago. And then you use tree ring dating and say, well, it dates to about 1065 A.D., so we're thinking maybe 900 to 1,000 years ago you had this lava. But then you use radiometric dating on it, potassium-argon dating, and it dates out to 210,000, 230,000 years. Well, how does that work? Got any questions? Well, it makes me ask a few questions. Mount Rangitoto, New Zealand, potassium argon dates the lava there at 485,000 years old, about a half million. But radiocarbon dates it at 300 years old. You see the trees that were killed in that lava. So do you believe it's 300 years old or 500,000 years old? Radiometric dating is super reliable. You go to the Kaupapa'ahu flow in Hawaii, and witnesses said and wrote down in history, this happened 1800 to 1801. And it's supposed to, the lava is supposed to be too young to have produced radiogenic argon or helium. And yet the both gases are there in large quantities. And there's different dating methods that were used. 12 dates were determined that range between 140 million years and almost 3 billion. The average is 1.4 billion. But history says a little over 200 years. You believe history? Or do you believe the radiometric dating? You see, now we're taking rocks. We know how old they are. You go to Mount Kilauea, or you have this active volcano. So we know the lava is new. But, you know, depth flowing into the ocean makes a difference. You go down to 4,680 meters, and it dates out at 21 million years old. 3,420 meters at depth at 12 million years old. At 1,400 meters at depth, it's zero age, brand new. Which one is it? It's the same lava. Got any questions? Yeah, I've got a lot of questions. Radiocarbon dating is believed still to be unreliable, that it's a fixed-as-we-go approach. There's lots of assumptions made. And Robert Lee said, no matter how useful it is, though, the radiocarbon method is still not capable of yielding accurate and reliable results. And the dates that are used are actually selected dates. So here's the conclusion I come up with. When you know how old the rock is, radiometric dating doesn't seem to work. But if you don't know how old the rock is, then the scientists want us to believe, if they're evolutionary scientists, that this is accurate. Got any questions? Anybody got a question? Yeah, here's my question. Are there any other ways to date the Earth? Well, what about population statistics? The present population growth rate's about 2%. And it's been pretty constant in spite of all sorts of wars and genocide and all the things that have happened in history. It's been pretty constant. So let's start out with an original couple. We could call them Adam and Eve. Better yet, let's call them Mr. and Mrs. Noah. Reproduce from that original couple at a rate of 2% a year. Do you know it only take about 1,100 years to have the present population of about 8 billion? I think we're at 8.3 billion now. Only about 1,100 years. Yeah, that's a lot more consistent with the worldwide flood happening about 4,300 years ago as opposed to man evolving in the last 1 to 8 million years, isn't it? Look at it from a different angle. If modern man's been around for only a million, we're going to be conservative and help him out. We're not going to the 3 or the 8 million. 1 million years, with the present population growth rate of 2%, do you realize if that were true, that the number of people on the planet would be 1 times 10 to the 8,600th power? Where would you put them and how would you feed them? Look at it from another angle. If modern man's been around only a million years, the population growth rate to produce today's population for that original couple would have to not be 2%, but 0.002%. That means the population would double only every 35 to 36,000 years. Now, young people, if you're not thinking already about this, I'm going to gross you out. What are we talking about here? We're talking about like Adam and Eve. They got a boy and a girl. It's going to take 35,000 years to get this up to 4 to double the population. So the guy marries his sister. Everybody else dies off. And the married couple, brother and sister, they have another couple. But see, the population will stay between 2 and 4 for 35,000 years. Now, you're already thinking, number one, that's gross. And number two, This doesn't make much sense. But then every 35,000 years, you go from 2 to 4 to 8 to 16 to 32 to 64, etc. Yeah, we go back just a million years. And the present population, about 8 billion, that's the rate. That's what it happened to be. Only a rate of 0.002% to get what we got today. That doesn't make much sense. And if you go back to 8 million years, it's even worse. Population statistics. Is this an example of combining old Earth theory with evolutionary uniformitarianism reasonable? Calculate any way you want to. Population statistics indicates a young Earth, not an old one. But that's not all. This thing about the Earth's magnetic field. The magnetic field of the Earth is so very important because it deflects so much harmful radiation that comes toward planet Earth. And yet this magnetic field is degenerating. And it may be one of the reasons we have some of the diseases we got going on today because of the radiation coming in from the outside and the magnetic field getting weaker and weaker, not deflecting as much radiation. Now, precise measurements have been made on this magnetic field since 1829. And since 1829, this rate of diminishing has been constant. The half-life of this magnetic field is about 1,400 years. Now, scientists say this rate can't have always been the same. You know why they say it can't have been the same? Evidence from our measuring for the last 200 years says it's been the same. But the reason they say it can't have been the same is if you go back to just 20,000 BC, the Earth's magnetic field would generate so much heat that what holds our Earth together would totally break up. And if you go back just to only 100,000 years ago, this magnetic field would generate so much heat, it would be equal to planet Earth becoming a neutron star. A star with a diameter about 8,000 to 10,000 miles. Huge heat. So they said, well, we know it can't be that. No, no, your evidence, your data shows that it's constant. I'm thinking this Earth's magnetic field of what we know indicates a younger Earth. The age of the atmosphere. I've shown you how these radioactive elements give off helium. Let's just start with no helium in the atmosphere at all. Do you realize by this process, it would only take 2 million years to generate the helium that we have today? That's an indication of a young Earth, not an old one. The accumulation of the ocean sediments. At the present rates, all the sediment in the ocean would accumulate in no more than 14 million years. Evolutionary way of thinking, that's young. The blanket of sediment on the ocean floor averages about 1,200 feet thick. If the oceans are actually a billion years old, like they tell us, the sediment would be about 100,000 feet thick, yet it's not. Indication of a young Earth. But somebody says, wait a second, why is there so much sediment on the Earth, even though it's not near like the evolutionists would have predicted? That's simple. First 11 chapters of Genesis tell us about that. It's called the worldwide flood. You talk about tremendous amount of sediment being formed. We're going to talk more about this a little bit later. The erosion of all the continents. You'd have a flat Earth in about 14 million years. So this, we have the Rocky Mountains and all the other mountains on the world, indicates a young Earth. You start off in the oceans with just distilled water, no salt. Do you realize the processes that are increasing the salt in the oceans would have the salt content to where it is now in about 62 million years if we started off with distilled water? That's an indication of a young Earth. And here's a doozy they don't like to talk about. The galaxies that wind themselves up too fast to be billions of years old. We live in the Milky Way galaxy. And the stars of the Milky Way rotate around the galactic center at different speeds. The inner ones rotate faster than the outer ones. So the rotational speeds are so fast that if our galaxies are more than a few 100 million years old, you know the billions that they say, it would be a featureless disk, not a spiral galaxy. Yet evolution is teaching our galaxy is about 10 billion years old. And the evolutionists now recognize this as the winding up dilemma. And they've known about it for the last 50 to 60 years. They don't talk about it much because it shows the Earth is actually, in their way of thinking, really young. Here's the deal. Time's running out on the theory of evolution. It's not what they've been telling you. And the truth will set us free.